Welcome back to the show. This is the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHP. Last night, the Royals beat the White Sox 10-1. Seth Lugo, his first victory as a member of the Royals. Lots of offensive stars. Tonight, 6:40, first pitch out of Kauffman Stadium. Brady Singer going to the mound.
B-Sing.
For the Royals. Let's talk to Mike McFarland about it. Mac, what's going on?
Hey, anytime you can pop eight runs up in the seventh inning, fine by me. But they're swinging it pretty well right now.
That's two good starts with Seth Lugo. Tell us what you like about the new Royal starter.
Well, I told you, the guy is sneaky. His fastball has jumped to it. His breaking balls are crisp. You got a veteran presence there between he and Waka and taking the pressure off of Brady Singer, who goes tonight. Look, if you want to look at veteran pitchers, just we've talked about it ad nauseum, so to speak, but just watch their demeanor on the mound. It's a job. It's a professional job of getting on there, focused on the pitch, and then executing it. You don't see them pace. You don't see them walk around and do anything else. When they get going, they're on a roll. They step on the mound and deliver the pitch. The defense is then on their toes. They get better jumps on ground balls. Everything is just clicking as best as they can. And that was just a dominant performance. And, again, you're not facing the 27 Yankees and the White Sox, but they're still professional hitters. And the play that Bobby Witt made up the middle in the second, third inning, whatever it was, that's one of those that just kind of pops the balloon a little bit, sucks the air out of him, and the pitcher continues to go to work, and he was dominant.
And you're right. The White Sox are not a good baseball team, but the Royals did just go to Baltimore, and they played well enough, except for the bullpen, where they could have won two out of three or maybe even swept at the bullpen. Had done their job. The starting pitching was good enough and has been good enough all season long. And so that's a great sign. And so, we talked about this with Lugo and Waka, the veterans that were added. Brady Singer now, some pressure off him where he can just be Brady Singer. The upside of Cole Reagans. And then we got to talk about Alec Marsh. That's the wild card. We were so happy to see him win the fifth starting spot over Lyles. And how could you ask for a better debut than what Marsh had over the weekend?
No, I agree. Back to the hitters first. You want to talk about being able to get on a roll. Well, when you're facing Burns for the Orioles and you put nine hits on him in five innings, the stuff that guy has, one of the top pitchers in the game, that'll get you on a roll offensively. But exactly. Marsh has been in good, and you've heard Bod and Bluma talk about how pitchers challenge each other and try and one-up them on the next start. That's the way that it's been. I mean, look, we keep, not that we forget about Reagans, but the job that he's done, how he's exploded on the scene. But just the presence of Waka and the way that he goes about his business and Lugo and now Marsh stepping in and like you said, taking that spot. Makes things a hell of a lot easier on Brady Singer, and looking for him to have an outstanding game again tonight. But, yeah, pitch after pitch, they're finally, that phrase from last year, pound the zone, attack the zone, whatever it was, is coming to fruition this year. And the back end of the bullpen, okay, cost us a couple, but let's see how things work themselves out because there's still some very good arms down there in the pen.
Yeah, that was kind of what we were talking about yesterday, Mac, when it was, losing because your bullpen blew a game is deflating and it's frustrating and you come in, we do the show the next morning, we're mad. But I said to Steven, look, I don't like the fact that they're 2-4, but if you were going to tell me that the team was 2-4 because the starting rotation looks really, really good and the bullpen's coughed up a couple, or they're 2-4 because the rotation looks like a complete mess, I would take what the Royals have right now. We went through the 32 different starting pitchers last year. They can sort. They can sort the bullpen out more reasonably, can't they? Than if they needed to try to somehow put together a starting rotation in the middle of the season.
Without question, you got a lot of. I don't want to say similar type arms, but similar velocity and you know, pitches and things along those lines. And it'll, it, you know, I'm still giving Will Smith the benefit of the doubt that he can come in and find it and get the job done. But, you know, if it comes to that situation, you got a lot of guys that can be that back end guy to come in and close out an inning. So, yeah, that'll sort itself out. I'm just very pleased with how the majority of the lineup is swinging the bat fairly well right now.
And one of those guys that's not swinging the bat very well is Vinny Pasquantino. At some point, he's going to. And so that's a good sign that they're able, right now, they're winning some games without the help of Vinny.
I know. And just the difference in what I see in Melendez right now. Renfro, he's a little on the struggle bus right now, but he's put some good swings on the ball here the last couple games. And, you know, one of my favorites is Kyle Isbell. Having him down at the bottom part of the order, they're all settling in. And, let's make some hay right now because we got a pretty nasty schedule coming up after this, starting with the Astros after the White Sox. But, again, you're dealing with a major league team in the White Sox. They have pride. You still got to go about your business. But this is definitely something where you can put some hay in the barn the rest of this weekend and keep that good feeling going against the Astros.
So let's sing the praises again of a couple of moves that J.J. Piccolo and that front office made. The scouting department, whoever you want to credit, Scott Sharp, they all deserve a tip of the cap. We've talked about the tremendous trade of Aroldis Chapman for Cole Reagans. And that if Cole Reagans stays healthy and continues to pitch at this level for the next couple of years, that'll go down as one of the best trades in Royals history. It was just fabulous. Because we got to remember what Aroldis Chapman was when the Royals signed him. They were able to fix him enough to where he was attractive to the Rangers, and they landed a guy that's their ace right now. The other trade that we need to remind people of that right now looks like an absolute steal was trading Jose Quas to the Cubs for Nelson Velasquez. And it's hard to get it's hard to get power, man. It's hard to get cheap power. And for the Royals to grab Velasquez last year, he hit 14 home runs in 40 games for him. And so far this year, he's off to a fast start. He's got a couple of homers. He's got an OPS over 1,000. And if they were able to go out and trade a sixth-inning guy, nothing against sixth-inning guys, but a sixth-inning guy for a legitimate, young, controllable power hitter that can lock DH down, what a move that was too, Mac.
Sixth-inning guy or a guy that can change the game with one swing of the bat. Yeah, I think that's pretty much how you can put it. It's just a different sound coming off that kid's bat when he barrels it up. It's just, if you're going to live with the long ball, you're going to live with all those other things that he can do, but you're also going to have to live with the fact that, he's got some swing and miss in that bat as well. So, look, what they get out of him is a run-producing bat down in the bottom third of the order that can drive in the heart of the order at any given time. But, again, with like you said, with Sharpie and J.J. And that whole front office and Mr. Sherman giving J.J., the chance to go out and spend some money to get these guys, that's why I'm so high on the on the Royals this season. It's just a good mix of finally some veterans to guide some of those younger players as they start to establish themselves in the big leagues.
So, Mac,
Green Powell,
you mentioned MJ Melendez for a second, and I feel like he's low-key been maybe the most. Well, I said to Steven before the season, I feel like he might be the biggest X factor in the lineup as to whether or not the lineup is one really excited about or not, because I think we know what we're going to get from Bobby Witt Jr. We expect to get good production from Vinny at some point as time goes on. But MJ Melendez had not really done a whole lot offensively his first couple years. He started to show some signs late last season. And here he is early, only the first week. But to come out of the gates like this, he's got an OPS of over 1,000. What are you seeing from him? And how important is it for a guy like that to get off to a good start?
Well, it is. It'll clear his mind a little bit. But I just don't see him going up there and flailing. Even in spring training, things were a little bit calmer. Everything just seems to have calmed down and slowed down for him, not trying to go for the pump every at-bat and then trying to shorten up. He's staying short right now. I can't remember what game it was where, you know, he took a first pitch off a lefty and kind of just let his hands work and hit a ground ball into the open left side of the infield. You didn't see that too often last year, especially on a first or second pitch of the at-bat. Those are some of the signs that he's starting to mature as a hitter and understand that the power comes in certain situations. You're not looking to do it on a two-strike count anymore. It's just the process of maturing as a big league hitter and staying within yourself and understanding his hands are his best asset, and keeping the body under control is a huge deal for him. And it looks like, just like I said, everything looks a lot calmer and things have slowed down for him with his brain and just letting the hands work a lot better so far.
Brady Singer, his first start, 7 innings, 3 hits, no runs, 1 walk, 10 strikeouts against the Twins. Tonight, he faces the Chicago White Sox. What made Singer so successful the first time around, and what are we looking for tonight?
Well, again, it just seems things are, he's looser. You don't see him trying to muscle up on the two-seamer. He had better action and trying to overthrow the slider. Everything just looks so much smoother and fluid and everything else. He's staying on his legs a little bit better, not getting as jumpy off the mound as he sometimes can do. I just think it comes down to the fact that he doesn't have to be the guy. And, you know, with Cole Reagans coming in last year, it didn't really go the way he wanted there in the second half, but just coming into this season, knowing that he had some of these other veteran pitchers who are expected to do a lot and take the pressure off him, seems to have worked. Again, one start, but it just looked absolutely filthy, the stuff he had in his first start.
I know it's come in blowout games, but is there any chance that Jordan Lyles can actually be an effective reliever for the Royals?
Why not? I mean, and instead of trying to pace himself for 3, 4, 5 innings, you know, he can go out and air it out and snap off that breaking ball, and things are a little bit crisper right off the get-go. Going to be fresher with the amount of rest that he's going to have. Why not have that guy in there, especially if that breaking ball starts to bite as well as it seems it is right now. Why not have him down there? You know you can stretch him out in one of those situations, but still, can he be effective to come and get the last 2 outs of an inning in the middle of a game? Absolutely.
How do you have any guys, like you said, you still are willing to give Will Smith the benefit of the doubt? Is there anybody else in the bullpen that you are intrigued by or excited by that could maybe get more opportunities in high-leverage situations?
Well, Zerpa's pretty dirty for me. Everything is late break on the stuff that he has. It's just a matter of the mindset if you do give him those high-leverage situations. With young pitchers, it's tough to get them to understand to trust their stuff when they know they're coming into that crunch time and a crunch situation where the tendency of the adrenaline overthrows everything and then you try and do too much. So seeing him get some of those situations, I think, is plausible just to see what they have. And kind of those are the things you work out in the first month of the season where you see what you have that you can continue to build on so it becomes the norm for them. And when everybody starts to settle into their, quote, roles down in the bullpen, he knows how to prepare better and come out and just execute his game plan.
Mike McFarland is our guest, and you mentioned that you like Isbell, and those questions of whether or not, you know, can he hold down center field? Do the Royals still need a center fielder? Tell me what you like about him, and do you think that he can be good enough to where the Royals don't have to worry about looking for a center fielder?
Well, the barrel stays on plane and stays through the zone quite a long time. I like how He stays in the middle of the field, and that barrel stays through the pitch. Again, we talked about this before, where as a young player, you're doing whatever you can, and you're living and dying to a certain extent with every at-bat you have to establish yourself and prove you are an everyday major leaguer and deserve to be at the major league level. So all of those things come into play as a young hitter, and right now, like everybody else, he just seems to be a little freer in there. He's hunting this pitch, and he's not missing it to a certain extent right now, but I like how the bat stays in the zone a long time with him, which then isn't going to make him so susceptible to some off-speed pitches. But I like him in center field. He covers the ground. He's got a decent arm. But, again, his ability to put the bat on the ball and make contact is the best part about him that I like.
All right, Mac, I want to switch topics to one of your former teams, the Oakland A's. Who have they're very close to severing ties with Oakland after 56 years, and it looks like until they're moved to Las Vegas in 2028, they will be making a minor league ballpark in West Sacramento their interim home for a couple of years, and so if indeed that happens, they'll be playing at Sutter Health Park in West Sacramento that has 10,624 permanent seats with lawn seating that boosts capacity to roughly 14,000. What are your thoughts about the West Sacramento A's?
How about the interviewer and the speech that the owner gave? It was just like, oh, dude, just you're digging a hole. Shut up. It was just embarrassing. You know, I grew up with the A's at the Coliseum watching Reggie Jackson, Sal Bando, Joe Rudy, Campy Campanaris. Had the opportunity to play there 2 years, which was one of the highlights of my career. You know, going to and playing on the field that you used to go watch games as a kid. 10,000 fans at the stadium. Now, don't get me wrong, it is a nice ballpark. They put a lot of money into it when they built it, and from what I understand, they're going to be sharing the field as well.
Oh, yeah.
With the Giants AAA team. So good luck with that. That field's just going to get absolutely trashed. It might as well look as one of the high school fields that get used, or, you know, year-round around here with the grass dying in the outfield. But I just feel bad for him. Such a proud organization. You know, Mr. Finley's rolling over in his grave right now with all this crap that's going on. But, you know, it is the sign of the times that, the city of Oakland didn't want to put more money into it because that place really, really, the Coliseum needs a fix-up. And you'd have to tear it down and build a new one, basically, is what it boils down to. So, you know, 10,000 fans, I think the A's players in a sold-out stadium, which I believe they'll get a sellout every night, will be good for the players a little bit because a major league team deserves to have fans in the stands. And right now at the Coliseum, they're just – haven't been, nor will they this year, get fans into that stadium.
I mean, yeah, that would be a dramatic improvement if they can get, with the lawn seats, 14,000. They've had six home games. They've been drawing an average of 6,400 fans, and so they could double the eyeballs that are on them right now. I will say this. So Major League Baseball Player Association, they have to approve this. After they assess factors such as player safety, weather, the suitability of dugouts and clubhouses, how would you feel as an opposing player having to come in and play a series in West Sacramento?
It is what it is. It would be the way that I put it to my players. You know, we're here. We still got a ball game to play. This does count. This does matter. Deal with it. Deal with the situation and go out, take care of business. Get your three wins and get the hell out of town. I mean, that's basically what it's going to boil down to. But, you know, it's going to have a spring training feel to it, especially with the lawn chairs parked in the outfield. But, again, it's still a major league game. You're playing a major league team. It's just one of the factors that weighs into it. They are going to have to, like, boost you know, some of the amenities for the big league players, including, you know, all the weights, the training room, all of the things that need to be in there, you know, per the Players Association. But the game still, the bases are the same, the mound distance is the same, the weather will be fine. It'll be a little warm during the summer, but it's not going to have the fog at night where the ball doesn't carry. The ball will jump a lot better at this ballpark. And, you know, it's still a game at the major league level that you got to address it as such.
Mac, always great talking baseball with you. Have a great weekend, all right?
You too. We'll see you, boys.
That's Mike McFarland. We'd like to just hold off on breaking first because Jake has a WrestleMania update for you. Nate, you've been asking about this several times.
Oh, yeah.
WrestleMania. When is WrestleMania? Jake, tell him. Isn't this your big holiday? Do you not celebrate anymore?
Oh, I still celebrate it. It's this weekend, correct?
Are you excited? Well,
it's a 2-day event now on the Peacock.
Why, like, don't you love Villain Rock? Isn't this what you're all about?
I do not like Villain Rock.
I do.
I don't.
That's what he needs to be.
No.
So he was scheduled to be, it's in Philadelphia, WrestleMania, yeah, okay. Nate. He was scheduled to be, do a public appearance and a whole bunch of fans showed up for, right? And he was supposed to be there around 4 o'clock. I guess he was a couple of hours late.
Couple of hours.
And they were mad. In Philadelphia. You know, Philadelphia fans can be unforgiving.
Yeah.
And so he finally got to the event, he took the stage and took the microphone. Mm-hmm. And he addressed why he was late. Would you like to hear The Rock addressing the Philly fans?
I would.
And explaining to them, because they're doing all these appearances leading up to WrestleMania.
Yeah.
Jake, play The Rock talking to Philly fans.
Rock, I'm sorry. Are you booing because
2 hours
The Rock was supposed to be here at 4 o'clock? Is that why you're booing? You're booing because The Rock was a little late. Is that why you were booing? Why was The Rock late? You want to know? You want to know why The Rock was late? Are you sure? You want to know why The Rock was late? He was watching YouTube, watching Jalen Hurts lose in the playoffs again. Rock, I'm saying, are you?
They didn't like that.
The Rock.
They didn't like that at all.
He's back to being a bad guy.
Mm-hmm.
The corporate champ.
They didn't like him saying that he was late because he was busy watching YouTube videos of Jalen Hurts losing in the playoffs against Seattle. That would include him losing to the Chiefs.
Yeah, I was hoping
Chiefs,
he would say losing to the Super Bowl, but implied.
Right.
It's a big one.
What do you think of that, Jake?
I like that.
Oh, do you?
Yes. I just don't like, I mean, the Villain Rock. And look, I like Cody Rhodes. I like Cody Rhodes.
Fine.
You know, so I'm not a big fan of the bloodline and all this nonsense. I don't know.
You need to watch this or not?
Yeah. I also like Seth Rollins. I'm a big Seth Rollins guy. He's the one who went into Cleveland and made fun of Cleveland and LeBron James. So that kind of won me over years and years ago. Yeah,
there it is. All right, just thought you'd like an update on The Rock.
I did. I like that. Yeah. I'm for big, the corporate
right.
champ.
I'm not a big Roman Reigns guy, and that's a tag team match they're fighting for the title. Roman Reigns and The Rock and the Bloodline or whatever against Cody Rhodes and Seth Rollins, WrestleMania 40. It's a 2-night event.
There's Jake with your WrestleMania update.
And it'll be on the Peacock.
Thank you. Thank you very much. We'll be back after this on WHB. Welcome back to the Border Patrol on Sports Radio 810 WHB. Stephen St. John and Nate Bucati with Jake Gutierrez on this Friday, April 5th, 2024. Let's say hello to our friend Greg Gurley, who was, I thought, supposed to be in studio, but Jake dropped the ball on that one again. Hey, Greg, good morning. How are you?
I'm doing good. I'm about as far away from the studio as it gets, so I apologize. I didn't know that was on the schedule.
Well, I just felt like last week.
Why do I sound what?
Last week you said, next time we'll be in studios. I don't know. Where are you at?
Yeah. I like to keep your hopes up.
Where are you?
I am in a I'm on a boat in the ocean somewhere, just having a little R&R.
very specific there. A boat in the ocean somewhere. Do you have any? Have you been kidnapped, Greg? Do you have any idea where you are? Or?
I don't really know exactly where we are. We're somewhere warm.
Are you close to Costa Rica?
Do you know which ocean you're in?
Not really. Yeah. I just sent you guys a picture.
What's the last thing you remember when you were on land?
The last thing I remember. I remember a 30-0 run by UConn, and then I just left.
Wow, there it was. So did Illinois. Okay, so let's. Can we ask you about transfer portal players that already said they're going to Kansas? Or I don't know the rules about this.
I don't know if we can say specific names, but obviously they're out there, and I think that they're it's very obvious that we are trying to, you know, find shooters and shot makers.
But what if he's already said he's coming to Kansas? What if he's already committed?
I just don't know about the official paperwork.
Yeah, I don't know either.
To not get ourselves in trouble.
Yeah,
I think if you're not living under a rock and you follow Kansas basketball, you know what we're talking about.
Right.
And, you know, a couple guys that, have the ability to create shots, get to the rim, shoot it at a high percentage. And, you know, we've talked over the last 3 weeks about how important it is to have shot makers and creative shot makers and guys that can, when the clock's running down, you know, who's going to come through. We watch it in the Final Four right now, and those guys that are in the Final Four have multiple guys like that on both sides, men's and women's. And so that was obviously something we were lacking, and that won't be a problem again, as we're going to stockpile some guys. It's going to be much more competitive in practices. It's not going to be a numbers thing where we don't have enough bullets in our gun. We're gonna have options, and the process isn't over. It's gonna go on for a while here, and he's going to build a team that can compete to play this weekend next year.
Okay, so let's talk about a different subject before we get to the men's Final Four. I just saw a really cool post from the Chiefs on Twitter. And it says, "You cheered for us, now it's our turn. All of Chiefs Kingdom is rooting for you tonight, Caitlin Clark." And they posted a picture, looks like she's probably around 8 years old, wearing Chiefs gear and wearing a Chiefs jersey with some other kids all dressed up in Chiefs gear. And she hasn't been shy about it. She's a big Chiefs fan, you know, being up in Iowa and coming to games and following the Chiefs. And now everyone loves the Chiefs, but it appears that she loved the Chiefs even when it wasn't fashionable to love them. So that's kind of cool. But tonight, the sports world will be focused on the women's Final Four. And I know there's been great players in women's basketball before. There's been great matchups. This just feels different. And maybe it's because of social media and everything else. But, I mean, Caitlin Clark dropping 41 points in the Elite Eight while, 13 or 14 million people watched against LSU. And now she takes on probably the greatest women's program of our lives, UConn, and Gino Auriemma, and Paige Beckers, who if there's any player that could be her equal, it's her. And she's going up against a team in UConn that didn't recruit her, even though that was Caitlin Clark's dream school, didn't recruit her. Went with Paige Beckers instead. So now she gets this storybook opportunity against UConn tonight. What about you? What do you think of all this? Because I think it's great, you know, and we're both fathers of daughters. And also, it's that last game, it's great basketball. She's just so entertaining to watch, and everyone's going to be watching tonight, it seems.
Well, there's so many storylines, and you named about all of them. You know, the fact that UConn has been the team throughout our generation. I think it's now 23 Final Fours for Gino Auriemma. But they haven't really been talked about a lot lately because it's been all South Carolina, it's been all Iowa, and it's been all LSU. Paige Beckers would be Caitlin Clark, at least the hysteria surrounding her right now, if not for those couple years of injuries, because she was on a crazy path, and she's still really, really good and would be the best player in the country if not for Caitlin Clark. So the storylines are all there. It's kind of captured everyone's attention. I've watched more women's basketball in the last month than I have in a long, long time, and it's been entertaining. It's been fun to watch. It's what I can't figure out is how you can't stop her, or at least slow her down. I mean, Kim Mulkey said it. No one else stopped her. You know, what are we going to do? And I just find it hard to believe that they can't, you know, when we, you can take people out of games, but for some reason she's so good, you can't gear your defense just to her. And her team's really good too. I mean, that's a big part of it. But I've just been surprised that she's been so consistent at a crazy high level that teams haven't been able to just face guard her, don't let her get it. And but we'll see what UConn has in store. I mean, you're going up against one of the probably the best women's basketball coach of all time, until someone comes out and changes it. And I guarantee you, he'll have something up his sleeve.
Well, I think one of the reasons she's so hard to contain, Greg, this probably seems like a foreign concept to you, but she passes really, really well.
Wow.
That's actually a really good dig, and it's 100% correct. Because she does. It's kind of like Trae Young. Remember, Trae Young was an unbelievable offensive player the one year he played at Oklahoma, but he also passed the ball so well. So he recognized that everybody was gunning for him, meaning he's going to get doubled and triple teamed. So he dished it off to the right guys. And Caitlin Clark is the same way. She's so smart that she feels the defense coming and gets rid of it. And she's one of the best passers in the country and for sure the best scorer. So good short question, Nate. I almost commented on Steven's question about Caitlin Clark. It was super long.
Right.
I was like, hey, is this bizarre world? Is this a role reversal day? But both kind of switched up today. So nice job.
She averages 9 assists a game. That leads the country by a lot. The second closest was 7.3. And, I mean, her range of passing blows. I mean, full court passes, you know, transition. They actually run in transition a lot. They play a really fast-paced style, which is exciting to watch, too. I think that's part of what maybe has captivated people about this women's tournament is the games have been exciting. There's big personalities, so you feel like you get emotionally involved in the game because you're rooting for somebody or you care about the outcome a little bit. But the other part, Greg, is like Steven mentioned, there have been great players in women's basketball. There have been great teams, but like this is the best player maybe ever, or at least, you know, statistically. And yet there's all this great competition out there because there's so much more talent around the women's game. Like, it's spread out, or maybe there's just more of it, so more teams have it in terms of how competitive this tournament is. And, like, shoot, we're not even talking about the undefeated team, right? Like, South Carolina is undefeated, and we don't even spend as much time talking about them.
Right.
How great would it be to see a rematch between South Carolina and Iowa in the championship game?
Well, I think the other thing that is very helpful for this interest in women's basketball is that ESPN and every major news outlet has covered it better. There's more, like, you didn't used to see this as the lead on SportsCenter. You didn't used to see, you know, it was usually like the fourth or fifth story. You know, it annoys me so much now when you watch those morning yelling shows on ESPN now during the men's Final Four week and women's Final Four week. And what do we get? Oh, what are they going to do with Dak Prescott? Or what are they going to do with Jordan Love? Like, it's April, and this is the biggest college basketball tournament of the year on both sides, and we're talking about salary cap crap about, you know, Denver. Who cares right now? Shows you that the NFL dominates the media, but that I'll get that off my chest. But I will say, on the flip side, they've done a much better job of covering, you know, on the main shows, on Scott Van Pelt or whatever, he'll lead with it. And I think the other thing that's made it so intriguing is that, kind of like a really good story, there's an antagonist, right? There's somebody that everybody likes, and then there's kind of a villain. And that Angel Reese has kind of got to where he keeps some people engaged more, and that's why that game was so So many people watched it the other night, that Monday night, because of that and because of the year before. So it's kind of had it all.
All right, Greg, let's talk quickly about the men's Final Four. I mean, is anyone going to give UConn a game?
I think so. I really do. I think Alabama, if they shoot it well, I know that sounds like a lazy statement, but they can, you know, the three ball changes basketball. And, you know, UConn, they shoot the three ball well too, but we saw what Alabama did against Carolina and then on into Clemson. Mark Sears is the college version of Jalen Brunson, and he can get his own shot. And if he can get rolling and they got those wing shooters, I mean, their whole offense is to break you down, play one-on-one basketball, take them basketball, pitch to the corner, get to the rim, throw an alley-oop, and it'd be a really fun style to play. They might get beat by 30, okay? But they could also beat UConn. Shots have to fall for them to be successful, but you got to give a lot of credit to Nate Oates and what he's done with that program. We lost a ton of guys last year and just reloaded. You know, we talk all the time around here about, oh, well, we lost three starters. What are we going to do at Kansas, at Kansas State, or Missouri? Hey, look at Alabama. They lost a ton of guys, and they're in the Final Four with a chance to win a national title. So I think it's going to be a better game than most people think. I mean, that's the easy take, right, is to say, well, it's been 10 games, and nobody's come within double digits of UConn. So, yes, that is the easy take. But I do think when you get to this, I thought we were going to have a little bit of a fracture when Illinois tied it up in that first half against UConn. You're like, okay, it was like 23-all or something late in the first half. And then they go on that 30-to-nothing run, which was ridiculous. And for some reason, Illinois kept throwing six-foot guards in there to try to dunk over Zach Edey, and it just didn't work. Donovan Clingan. And I don't know when they got that message that they should try something different. But anyway, we'll see what happens. I do think UConn will win, but I think Alabama's got a chance, a real chance.
And if UConn doesn't get upset and Purdue holds off NC State, that could actually be a really good national championship game between UConn and Purdue.
Yeah, I totally agree. UConn and Purdue would be the matchup. That'd be the LSU, Iowa, and the women's side, right? And it'd be Zach Edey, and see if he can finally get over that hurdle. It'd be, you know, Purdue never won a national title, hadn't been to the Final Four in, what, 44 years or something like that. And they've been such a steady program. And you know, by all accounts, I don't know Matt Painter, but it sure seems like he's a good guy and says all the right things. So you kind of want to root for him. But, the NC State team is also that destiny-type team that what they've done, I don't know if you can compare that to anything else, because five games in a row, number one, years ago, that didn't happen. It was usually at the most four, but they won five games in a row in the ACC tournament and then barreled through, you know, on a team where we talk about all the time about, hey, God, tired legs, gosh, how do they play 37 minutes? Well, for the last nine games, they've done that. And one of their guys isn't exactly the most in-shape guy in the world, and he hadn't complained. I mean, DJ Burns has kind of captivated this year's tournament, along with a few other guys. And so if I'm CBS and TBS, I'm excited because there's a ton of storyline for this men's Final Four.
All right, Greg, have fun in the ocean.
Yeah,
have a safe
theme song for you, Greg.
Safe trip, man.
I sent you a picture. We're in Harbor Island, Bahamas.
What's that again?
Harbor Island, Bahamas.
Ah, all right, then.
Some dad bod pics.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah, no, we don't really need those.
Enjoy your rest and relaxation, Greg.
All right, boys. I really miss you.
Yep, sounds like it. It's Greg Gurley. Thank you, Greg.
Feelings mutual.
Like to
take a picture of himself, like on top of a shark.
Maybe. I mean, Jake would probably like that.
Yeah. Just like the.
No.
Was the old coach from the Florida Gators?
McElwain? No. Wasn't him.
I thought it was the guy from what restaurant?
The Jimmy John's guy.
Yeah, Jimmy John's.
Not him either.
Jimmy John's.
But what you can do is you can join me tomorrow at my Hy-Vee.
Will you be on a boat?
Maybe.
Awesome.
29 and 64th Street in the Northland. I'm going to be there tomorrow from 10 until noon for a good old-fashioned meat sale.
Yeah.
So come out and see me for a good old-fashioned meat sale. You could stop in and get incredible deals from the butcher block. Also, Hy-Vee is having a graduation open house from 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. How's that sound? That's pretty good, isn't it? A perfect time for parents and graduates to see and taste options for the graduation parties. So stop in Saturday, tomorrow, at Hy-Vee off 29 and 64th Street in the Northland and see me from 10 until noon at Hy-Vee right here on Sports Radio 810 WHP. All right, let's do what the song says and give it away now. How about this? Who wants a four-pack of tickets to Monday's Kansas City Comets home playoff game? Give it away,
call
give
now,
it away, give
now.
It away now. Give it away, give it away, give it away now.
Call now, call now.
Nate Bucati, you got your work over there?
Yeah.
Why don't you read that in your fake announcer voice?
Your Kansas City Comets are in the playoffs, riding a six-game winning streak fueled by MVP candidate Zach Reggette. The Comets are the hottest team in the MASL. The Comets host Utica City this Monday, April 8th at 6:30 p.m. presented by Community America Credit Union at Cable Dahmer Arena. Visit our friends at ticketsforless.com for Comets single game tickets.
I give you a four-pack just for listening. Caller number. You want to give 2 4-packs? I got 4 sets. I'll give away 2. Callers 8 and 10 at 913-3810-810. 913-3810-810. Now we play Midnight Express, the theme to the movie Midnight Express, and a theme to the Kansas City Comets when I was a child. I do not encourage children to watch this movie as I did. Although Jake's favorite scene... Oh, Billy. As right now, Jake smashes his breast up against the glass, mimicking that scene, that iconic scene. This song represents indoor soccer and smuggling hash. And Turkish prisons. And
you ever
indoor
been in a
soccer.
Turkish prison?
Indoor soccer. In a Turkish prison. For smuggling hash. Indoor soccer. Comets in the playoffs. Oh, Billy. You like this, don't you, Jake?
Whole thing makes me very uncomfortable.
This song also was the ring walk song to one of my favorite tag teams of all time, the Midnight Express. Beautiful Bobby Eaton and Dennis Condrey, managed by gentleman Jim Cornette and his loaded tennis racket.
That thing was loaded.
You better believe it. That's quite a segment.
You guys are talented.
Did you get some winners?
We got our winners.
Who are they?
They're on hold.
Okay, you're on hold. Stay there.
Stay there.
You're winners. We'll be right back after this. Thank you to the Kansas City Comets. Go Comets. We'll see you again, WHP.